Welcome to the serial audiobook Alight, an unabridged podcast of Book 2 in the Generations Trilogy. Written by Scott Sigler, performed by Emma Galvin. This novel is available in print, ebook, or as a full-length audiobook. For links to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Audible, please visit scottsigler.com/alight. Hello, junkies. Ariel Girl and I are back from Phoenix Comic Con. The next two Friday fixes are going to feature panels that I was on. There is some funny stuff coming your way. So you get a slice of the con experience without suffering 118 degree heat like I did. Oh, what? You didn't hear about the heat? My endless social media complaining about the heat? You must not be following me on Twitter and on Instagram, where I'm at Scott Sigler, one word, or on Snapchat. Go there, search for Scott Sigler, one word, and add me. And boom, you can hear me kvetch about weather in the future, because I'm just that entertaining. There's no talky-talk after this episode, so let's get you caught up on the story, and then we will get into it. Previously on Alight, M. Bishop, Coyotl, Borjigan, and Callie survived the Springer attack and now find themselves atop three huge spiders, mechanical war machines that respond to their commands. M and the others have found a possible solution to the problem of the toxic mold, and they need to get it back to the other birthday children. Meanwhile, Aramovsky has been at the shuttle all along, doing his best to undermine M's authority. In this episode, Aramovsky and M clash yet again. And now, episode 13 of Alight.
Three spiders stride through the jungle. Long legs keep them above the dense underbrush. Their yellow, brown, and green coloring fades into our surroundings. They rattle, whine, and vibrate in a way that doesn't seem right. If the machines were newer, not so beat up, I imagine they would be as silent as the circle stars they were made for. The ruins pass by. Blurs of all sizes buzz through the canopy. Some trees grow impossibly high, their wide, dark yellow leaves drinking in the light. The same vines that cover the city's buildings dangle from tall branches. Late afternoon sun filters through, making leaves glow with a fuzzy warmth. The beauty of Omeokan takes my breath away. The dense underbrush gives way. We find ourselves on the bank of a wide river. Tall trees rise up on either side, forming a deep, living, yellow chasm that borders angry water. Blurred skim the surface, dipping in to snatch up this planet's equivalent of tiny fish. Ahead of us, the riderless spider doesn't slow. Long legs plunge in, and the machine turns downstream. The spider that Bishop and I ride follows, metal body half submerging, leaving us just a bit above the roiling surface. It's almost like riding in Grandpa's canoe during summer vacation. Grandpa's canoe? A Matilda memory. I remember Grandpa's laugh, his stubbly face. The canoe was red and always smelled of old fish. It seems so real, like it isn't Matilda's experience at all, but mine. How can that be? I was created on a spaceship. And yet, I remember how Grandpa liked to tinker with old useless antiques he called watches. He liked to show me the little bits and parts inside that fit together just so. If Grandpa were here, maybe he could fix these rattly machines. I glance behind us, at the limp-legged, whining spider that carries Coyotl, Callie, and Borjigan. Like me, Callie looks everywhere for any sign of the purple fruit. Does it grow on trees? Perhaps on a kind of smaller plant we haven't seen yet. Borjigan's eyes are closed, his head nestled against Coyotl's neck. Coyotl's arm is around Borjigan's shoulder, but he stares straight ahead, eyes scanning the riverbanks. The way they sit together. Like Spingate found Gaston, I think Borjigan and Coyotl have found each other. I wish Bishop would put his arm around me like that, hold me tight. It would be nice to relax into him, not have to think about all the things, all the time. See any fruit? He asks. I shake my head. Neither have I. After Smith looks at you, we can take the spiders out and cover more area. If we don't find the fruit, Em. He doesn't finish. He doesn't have to. If we don't find the fruit, we need to find the Springers again, and this time, we will be the ones attacking. I wanted to talk to them, to make peace, but they ambushed us, unprovoked. We did nothing wrong. They started this fight, not us. We're out of food and out of options. If it's war they want, they messed with the wrong girl. Ahead, the city's vine-covered walls rise above the trees, stretching in either direction from the river that cuts between two towers. White spray rages up from the twisted bars and bent grates that perhaps once prevented anything other than water from passing through. But judging by the amount of rust, that was ages ago. On top of the towers, I see long tubes that resemble the ones on the spiders' backs. Weapons. Once upon a time, I bet those protected the city. Now they are just rusted junk. The spiders stick to the river, easily walk by the water gate's remnants, past the wall, Ukmal's four-sided buildings, abandoned, but not destroyed. The buildings are smaller here than they are around the landing pad, but they get bigger the farther we go. We hear the waterfall long before we see it. When we turn a bend, there it is before us. The river just drops away. Beyond it, open air, and an amazing view of the city. The observatory soars higher than any other building, so obnoxiously large, it makes the rest of Ukmal look small and weak. We pass by the switchback steps that Spingate, Coyotl, and Farrar climbed. Like the spider that chased us then, or we thought was chasing us then, our three spiders don't seem interested in tackling those steep steps. Off to my right, I see the pool where Bishop saved me from falling, where he held me, where he kissed me. If he remembers that moment, he gives no indication. He stares straight ahead. I'm pretty sure the landing pad is southwest of us, but the spiders are heading due west. Bishop, where are we going? His brows knit with worry. I don't know. I told them to go to the shuttle. Maybe they're heading to their nest. We now know it's not a nest, but the word still works. Should we get off? I ask. Find our own way back? He considers it, shakes his head. Your wound is worse than you think. The less you walk, the better. We're still getting closer to the shuttle, just not heading straight for it. Let's stick with the spiders for now. Three spiders stride down the middle of a narrow, vine-choked road. On their backs, ride five tired, hungry people. Bishop guessed right. Up ahead is the nest building. It is a strange construct, and big. Not as large as the observatory, of course, but easily bigger than the food warehouse. Vine-covered like all the rest, although it's not a ziggurat. If anything, it reminds me of a really, really big version of... No, that can't be right. Bishop, what does this place look like to you? He turns his head left, then right, taking it all in. It's long and narrow. It's the only one I've seen with a curved top. I guess if it wasn't covered in vines, it might look a bit like... His eyes go wide. He stares at me, astonished. It looks like our shuttle. I nod. That's what I thought, too. It's 100 times larger. So large I thought it was a building. But beneath a deep blanket of vines is the same streamlined shape as the ship that brought us down to Omeokan. We approach. I see lumpy piles of vines, some in the street, some closer to the nest. We pass one. It is an unmoving spider, blanketed by plants and moss. In places, little flowers jut from it. Petals in shades of red and yellow. Tiny blurs buzz in and out. How long has it been since this spider stopped moving? Armand walks past it toward a wide open archway in the ship-shaped building. Blackened metal lines the archway's edges, like there was once a door here that was melted, ripped down and burned. The unmanned spider enters first. We follow it in, Coyote right behind us. This building, it's cavernous. Huge girders soar above. Attached to them, machines that haven't moved in years. Here and there, holes overhead, rusted out spots with dangling vines and sunlight cascading down. Rust is everywhere. Rust and wreckage. Unmoving, five-legged spiders are scattered all over. Some sit in an endless line of small, cozy stalls that seem to run the length of the building, nestled in like we were in our coffins. Some spiders on their sides, some on their backs, legs curled in as if they were real spiders, dead and dried up. And in places, pieces of spiders. A rusted abdomen attached to a rack on the wall here. Piles of ruined and useless legs there. Stacks of metal tubes over there. I think of Grandpa's watches, all the little bits needed to make them run. Those are spare parts, I say, pointing to the pile of legs, the stacks of tubes. I gesture to the whole building. This was some kind of factory, I think. A place to fix spiders that stopped working. Our mount strides into an empty stall. On either side are metal racks packed with equipment that seems long since dormant. Moss grows on everything. The spider lowers to its belly. Bishop steps down. He reaches his hand up to help me. I don't need his help, but maybe I want it. I take his hand in mine. His skin is so warm. Stepping over the ridge, I try my best to slide down gracefully, but as soon as my boots land on dirt and dead vines, my legs wobble. I'm weak from the long ride. I take one step and they give out. I fall fast, but Bishop is faster. His big hands cinch around my waist. I hear my spear clatter to the ground. Bishop holds me upright like I weigh nothing at all. Are you all right? I feel dizzy, and not just from blood loss. He's staring at me, concerned. His dark yellow eyes locked onto mine. Yes, I say. I think I'm all right now. He sets me on my feet, but doesn't let go right away. He holds on a moment too long. He's smiling. I smile back. Then, as fast as the moment came, it's gone. Bishop blinks a few times, slowly releases me, takes a step back. He looks like he wants to say something. Something I know I long to hear. But instead, he calls out to the others, his powerful voice echoing off the rust-eaten walls and ceiling. We can't stay here long. Em needs to get back, so take a quick look and let's go. He picks up the spear, hands it to me. I'm suddenly so tired. Bishop was right. My wound is worse than I thought. We have to get back to the shuttle. I know this, but I can manage for a little bit more. This place, it's important. It is the answer to a question. I just don't know what that question is yet. Callie walks over, her little head tilted back. She turns slow circles, taking it all in. A factory, she says. Amazing. It had to come from Zolotl, just like our shuttle. Hey, come look at this. It's Coyote, his voice echoing from farther in the building. He's with Borjigin, who stares upward, mesmerized. We walk to join them. Once again, my spear is less weapon, more cane. Coyote is gawking up at the curving wall, his head tilted so far he has to take a quick step backward to keep from falling on his butt. He points. I crane my head. Look. Nothing but more rust and vine-covered machinery. I start to ask him what he sees. Then, the image clarifies. The thing I'm looking at? Up high. It's the top of a machine that stands on the ground. A moss-speckled machine shaped roughly like a person. A giant person made of rusted blue metal. One arm ends in a wide, thick scoop, the other in a huge three-pincered claw. In some places, I can see right through the giant to the rusted-out wall behind it. Bordigan is nodding, mumbling to himself. I've seen this enough times to know what is happening to him. A flash fire. A builder, he says. It's a Bessatrix, terraformer, Model C4. He looks at me, confused. I've seen these before, but I haven't. I couldn't. My creator, I think he helped design Ukmal. He knew how to operate these machines, how to maintain them, maybe even repair them. So the halves can do more than whisper in a leader's ear and count food. As organized and methodical as they are, I suppose it makes sense they would be the ones to design cities. I'm surprised they operated these machines themselves, though. But perhaps something so complicated couldn't be left to a simple empty. Bordigan looks down the length of the building, nodding, eyes hovering on more giant machines. Each one he sees makes him mumble gibberish. I don't really understand what the machine is called, what it is supposed to do. It's nice that he remembers, but it doesn't matter. These machines are dead. Some are squat and look more like small buildings than people. Some have scoops. Some have great spikes. Some have saws so big they would neatly slice our shuttle in half. Some have wide-walled, empty areas that could hold a small mountain's worth of dirt and rock. Bordigan laughs. His eyes dance with delight and with life, his fatigue forgotten for the moment. That's why we haven't seen anyone in this city, alive or dead, he says. The grown-ups didn't build Ukmal. These machines did. Bishop shakes his head. But the grown-ups had to tell the machines what to do, didn't they? Where to go, what to build? Yes, but they could do that from up there. Bordigan points a slim finger skyward. His words overwhelm me. When the observatory said we were the first people to set foot on Omeokan, I thought it was wrong. It wasn't. We've searched hundreds of buildings and found nothing. No grown-ups, no bones, no sign of anyone ever having been here before us. The machines built Omeokan. Matilda and her kind have never come down. That means the observatory was telling the truth. It is a place, the only place, where we can get actual answers. Was it also telling the truth about Matilda? Was her rebellion made of murder, or did her actions actually save lives? My knees give out. Only the spear keeps me standing. Bishop cups my elbow. Em, are you all right? I'm fine, I say. It's a lie. He knows it. My shoulder is killing me. If I don't get to the shuttle soon, Bishop will have to carry me yet again. We're leaving, I say. We still have hours of walking before we reach the landing pad. Bordigan shakes his head. Give me a few minutes. I'm guessing the spiders are programmed to come back here after a fight. So what? Bishop's words are a growl. Em needs Dr. Smith. The sooner the better. I would have expected Bordigan to shrink away from Bishop, but the boy stands tall. I think I can give the spiders new orders, he says. I need a few minutes and Coyote's help. The spiders can get us to the shuttle faster than if we're on foot. Bordigan is nothing like the stammering coward he was in the jungle. He's confident, believes in what he says. Make it quick, I say. Coyote and Bordigan run to their spider and get to work. Bishop wants to disagree, but we're back in the city, and I hold the spear. It's my turn to give the orders again, and I'd much rather ride instead of walk. 26. Smith said I had a flesh wound. Nothing serious, at least according to her. I was in her coffin only long enough to make sure the bleeding had stopped, long enough for Spingate and Gaston to take a quick look at what we brought back. There isn't time for anything more right now. Decisions have to be made. My people are once again packed in the coffin room on deck one. I stand on the makeshift stage with Gaston and Spingate, who each have something important to say when I am finished. So many emotions on the faces that look back at me. A mixture of pride, disgust, respect and doubt, of love, fear and anguish. We are too many to all think the same way. I tell my people what happened, the snake wolf, the springers, our run through the jungle, the spiders, the nest that must have come from the Zolotl, and, of course, Visca. Many of the younger kids are crying. This is their first experience with death. Even if they weren't close to Visca, they knew who he was, and they know he is never coming back. The young circle stars don't cry, though. They now wear black coveralls and hold weapons of their own. Axes, machetes, shovels, hammers. One girl even holds a pitchfork. While Bishop and I were gone, Farrar was getting them ready. Good. When we fight the Springers again, we will need everyone. After I finish, Gaston explains how the Springer guns work. He says they are muskets, primitive versions of the grown-ups' bracelets. The fabric that goes into the barrel is an explosive material. When it ignites, the barrel channels the explosion, drives a metal ball out fast enough to kill. Maybe it is primitive in Gaston's opinion, but it makes our weapons look worthless in comparison. "Em and the others brought back 5 muskets," he says. "Each one is handmade. The parts aren't really interchangeable, which is strange to me. Maybe they don't have factories that can mass produce these. There is enough ammunition to fire each musket 7 times. Beckett and I think we can use the shuttle to make more ammunition, maybe even more muskets, but we're not sure yet." Gaston steps back, his lecture finished. The people look terrified, and I don't blame them. There are monsters in the jungle that can kill us before we can even see them. Spingate holds up the bashed purple fruit. She trembles with excitement. "We tested it on the contaminated food," she says. "The juice of this fruit kills the red mold." A roaring cheer rips the air. People grab at each other, unable to contain their joy. Gaston hugs Spingate, squeezes her, and slaps her on the back so hard she winces and laughs. "If we can find enough fruit, we have an entire warehouse of food, years' worth, enough to keep us alive while we learn to farm and hunt. Everyone is hungry, but now there is hope." Aramovsky clasps his hands together and looks skyward. "It is a miracle," he says. "We are delivered." "Hardly," Spingate says quickly. "We only have this one fruit. We need many more so we can experiment, find the best way to use it. If this was really a miracle, we'd have all the food we wanted, wouldn't we?" Aramovsky grins. "It's not a miracle that on the very day we run out of food, we discover fruit that will let us survive. It's not a miracle that we suddenly have guns and war machines. The gods provided tools of salvation. That doesn't mean they're going to do the work for us." He steps onto the stage. I see O'Malley bristle. He doesn't like this. Well, that's too bad. Whispering in my ear isn't going to stop our enemy. "The demons murdered brave Visca," Aramovsky says. "May the gods welcome him home." In unison, half the crowd repeats his words. "May the gods welcome him home." A chill runs through me. How did they all know to say that? So many speaking at once. It calls back Matilda's vague memories of being in church. While I've been looking for food, how many people has Aramovsky talked to? "They're not demons," Spingate says. "They're intelligent beings." "They attacked us, for no reason," Aramovsky says. He points to the fruit in her hand. "And they could have given us the secret to survival any time they liked. They did not because they are evil. They want us all to die." Grumbles of agreement, heads nodding. Even though he's talking about demons and gods, is the core of what he says so wrong? We did nothing to the Springers. "Now we have weapons," he says. "We must take the spiders into the jungle and destroy the demons. The only way we can be safe is to wipe them out." People murmur their approval. I usually disagree with Aramovsky. But this time he's right. The Springers attacked us once. They will attack us again. If I want to save lives, we need to kill our enemy. We need to be forever free. Aramovsky puts his arm around my shoulders, keeps talking to the crowd. "Em knows what must be done. She killed one of them. She will lead us into battle. We will win this war, and the gods will be splat." The purple fruit hits his face, spins down to the floor where it lands in a wet pile. He stares, stunned. Smelly juice drips from his skin. In the following silence, Spingate growls her words at Aramovsky. Battle? Kill them all? You superstitious idiot. She casts her glare about the room. And all of you, blindly agreeing with anything he says. Are you stupid? We can't go to war with the Springers. We need them. Aramovsky's arm slides away from my shoulders. As it does, I can feel his hatred, an almost physical thing. I thought you knew math, he says to her. There is only so much fruit. It's us or them. Spingate rolls her eyes. You want to wipe out an intelligent race that could show us how to survive? The red mold isn't the only threat here. What about poisons the purple fruit won't purify? What about the snake wolves or other predators we haven't seen? How many people in this room need to die before we understand what's safe and what isn't? The Springers know how to survive on Omeokan. We don't. Her words chisel away at the vengeful feeling in my chest. She's right. We've only been here a few days. There could be more dangers. Without someone to guide us, each lesson we learn might come from someone getting hurt, or worse. Coyote bangs his thigh bone against the shuttle wall. He's standing with Borjigin, both of them looking over the crowd of smaller kids in front of us. They killed Visca, Coyote says. We could have killed them first, but we didn't. First chance they got, they attacked us. Aramovsky is right. They're demons. Spingate shakes her head. They're not demons. You didn't see them, Borjigin says. They're horrible to look at. She screams her answer. We probably look horrible to them. We have to find a way to communicate. We can't just march into the jungle and slaughter them. We can, Aramovsky says. We must. On the largest building in this city stands a statue of M, of our own leader. It is a sign from the gods that she is destined to lead us to victory. Aramovsky smiles at me, eyes blazing with intensity. He wants me to embrace this destiny. But it's not a statue of me. It's supposed to be Matilda. The way Aramovsky says it, though, it's hard not to wonder if he's right. Matilda isn't on Omeokan. I am. Can't old things take on new meanings? The observatory has signs too, Spingate says, staring at me. I'm suddenly the object of a battle between two powerful people, each trying to sway me to their way of thinking. Remember those signs, Em? She says. Should we make them all come true? The images of death, of torturing gears and halves, murder of people like Spingate, Gaston, O'Malley, Zubiri, Borjigin. Of course not, I say. But that's not the same thing. The Springers aren't like us. Spingate shrugs. How would we know? You said there were children, families. Sooner than you think, we'll have families too. Our children will inherit Omeokan. What kind of a planet do you want them to have? One of war or one of peace? Our children. That's crazy. We're not old enough for... No. We are. Spin and I... Bodden, Smith, Johnson, Cabral, Opkick, D'Souza. We all have the bodies of young women, not kids. And those of us that are kids won't stay that way for long. A little girl hops on top of a coffin. Wallazak, Zubiri's quiet friend. We should destroy the demons before it's too late, she says. Her face contorts with rage. She pounds her fist into her palm as she talks. Aramovsky is right. This planet was made for us. If we want it, we have to show that we're worthy. Kill them all! Kill them all! Half the room erupts in roars and cheers. So much hate on Wallazak's little features. It shocks me. Disturbs me. She should be playing with dolls, not calling for slaughter. But she has a double ring on her forehead, like Aramovsky. She was made to preach religion. Spingate waves her hands above her head, demanding the crowd's attention. War isn't a game, she shouts. If we try to solve this with violence, it won't just be Springers that die. We have a few guns. The Springers have more. She points at the Circle Star girl, holding the pitchfork. What about you, Mariha? Will you die from a bullet in the face? Spingate points at Borge again. Or you? Maybe a knife in the belly? A wound so bad even Smith's coffin can't fix it? So you die slow, screaming for help that no one can provide? Is that worth fighting our ugly enemy, Borgigan? Borgigan's eyes are wide. He doesn't answer. They were here first, Spingate says. There could be thousands of them. Hundreds of thousands. If we attack them and fail, do you think 5 muskets and 3 spiders will stop them from pouring in here to wipe us out? What if they shot Visca because they thought we were attacking them? Aramovsky yells something at her. Gaston yells something back. But their arguments become background noise as her words bounce through my thoughts. What if they thought we were attacking them? The city beyond the walls, utterly destroyed. Demolished buildings. Deep craters. There was a war before we even arrived. The spiders, knocking down the wall of that building where we first found a campfire. Spiders. Attacking and killing the Springers in the clearing. Spiders, with the Circle Star symbol. Visca, his sweat washing the camouflage from his face, exposing that same symbol on his forehead. The pieces click together. So many people screaming no one is listening. Those for war and those against it are arguing, even pushing each other. I slam my spear butt hard on the stage. Enough! Everyone shut up! Aramovsky smiles. He thinks I will take his side. He's wrong. The Springers attacked us. Yes, I say. They killed Visca. Yes. But I don't think they're demons. If anything, to them, we are the monsters. Aramovsky looks shocked, betrayed. That's ridiculous, he says. We aren't monsters. We are the chosen people. Spiders kill Springers on sight, I say. The spiders standing outside this shuttle have hundreds of little dents from Springer bullets. The ruins outside the walls are from a huge city. The spiders destroyed that city. They must have killed thousands of Springers. When you say we didn't do anything to the Springers, you're right. We didn't do anything. But our creators did. I tap my forehead. We all have symbols. Visca's was the Circle Star. The same symbol that's painted on the spiders. What if the Springers saw his symbol? A symbol they must fear, they must hate, and acted just like we would act if someone came to kill us. Spingate's eyes crinkle with a small smile. She's impressed. I found a possible connection that she missed. We don't know where the fruit grows, she says. If we kill the Springers, we might not find it at all. That gnawing feeling in your bellies? It's going to get much, much worse. The fastest way to get rid of it is to find the Springers and talk to them. Make them understand we are not our creators, that we mean no harm. A few hands reactively go to stomachs. Aramovsky uses gods to get through to people. Spingate does the same with hunger. Aramovsky shakes his head, his stare now burning with hatred. So one of us should just walk out past the wall and ask these killers for help. You already said how we would die horribly, Spingate. So who is going to go? You? She nods. Yes. Me. The crowd falls silent. They can't believe she just volunteered. Neither can I. She points to her forehead. I don't have a Circle Star. If M's right, maybe that will give me a chance. M also said that Springers were about her size, which means they are about my size. Maybe I won't be as intimidating as Visca was. Maybe they won't shoot me right away. She is so brave, and I am instantly proud of her all over again. Inspired by her. This is my friend. My courageous friend. Gaston grabs her arm. Maybe isn't good enough, he says. It's too dangerous for you. She pulls her arm away, holds it up, showing her golden bracer. If we do make contact, and they show us anything about the purple fruit. Aguirre needs to see it. Callie did her part. Zubiria's too little. Now it's my turn. In a panic, Gaston grabs for her bracer. Then I'll go. I'm even smaller than you. She twists away from him. What are you doing? Stop it. I raise a booted foot high, stomp down on the stage as hard as I can. The sound is almost as loud as a musket shot. It silences everyone, stops everything. Gaston, you're staying here, I say. If the Springers do attack, you might have to fly the shuttle to get everyone away safely. He snarls at me. Beckett can fly the shuttle. Make someone else do this. You can't let Spingate go alone. She won't be alone, I say. I'm going with her. Shouts of support, of disbelief. Aromovsky smiles, folds his arms and watches. O'Malley steps toward the stage. He's coming in for a whisper. I hold up my hand to him, palm out. He stops in place. Don't bother, I say. This is going to happen. Bishop bangs his axe head against the coffin room wall, demanding everyone's attention. Send me instead, he says. Just me. I move quieter than anybody. I can capture one and bring it back here. O'Malley comes forward again. He's right, Em. Listen to Bishop. Taking a prisoner is an act of war, Spingate says. Even if Bishop gets one, we have no idea if we can make it tell us what we need to know. Too many voices, too many opinions. I raise the spear over my head. Enough! I've made my decision. Only two people are going. The leader, who has the authority to speak for all of us, and the scientist, who can understand what we see. Spingate's eyes meet mine. We are bound together in this. We were the first of our people to awaken. We found each other before we found anyone else. If we are to die trying to stop a war, then we will die as we began, together. The observatory, I say. We'll go there. She shakes her head. I think this city is our territory, and the jungle is theirs. We need to go to them as a gesture of good faith. Can you take us to the clearing where Visca died? I remember the way Visca examined the trail, the surrounding plants, the footprints. I watched him carefully. Maybe I couldn't find my way from the old fountain to that clearing. But just like he did, I can follow the path from the gate to the first fire pit, then to the clearing where he died. I look at the boys who don't want us to go. Aromovsky, O'Malley, Bishop, and Gaston. And I thump the spear butt lightly against the stage floor. The decision is made. And it is final.
That is it for this week, ladies and gentlemen, junkies of all ages. We will be back next week with episode number 14 of Alight. And make sure you're listening for the Friday Fix. We're going to run a panel, a whole panel from Phoenix Comic Con. It'll be in the feed and you guys will dig it. So back next week with Alight episode number 14. And until then, I will talk to you all real soon. You have been listening to Alight, book 2 in the Generations trilogy. Written by Scott Sigler, performed by Emma Galvin. Produced by Adrian Galvin and engineered by Steve Rickyberg. Follow Scott on Twitter and Instagram, where his handle is at Scott Sigler, S-C-O-T-T-S-I-G-L-E-R, one word, or join our Facebook group at facebook.com/Scott Sigler. Theme music is the song Unseen Horrors by Kevin MacLeod.